This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. From the mid-1960s to the mid-1970s, the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, like schools across the country, saw the emergence of a black student movement. Joy Ann Williamson has written a history of these years at Illinois. The title of the book, Black Power on Campus, the University of Illinois, 1965 to 75. Joy Ann Williamson, an alumna of the U of I, is an assistant professor of education at Stanford. She's back on this campus as part of the university's commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the Brown v. Board of Education decision. Professor Williamson is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Later today, she'll speak at the Alana Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. That event is set for 4:30 this afternoon, the 17th of October. The Alana Union Bookstore is at the corner of Wright and Daniel Streets in Champaign. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. By the way, if you're listening locally and you call that local number, 333-9455, and you can't get through, give us a call on the toll-free line, 800-222-WILL. We're having a little phone difficulty today here at AM 580. Our guest, Joy Ann Williamson, her book, Black Power on Campus, is published by the University of Illinois Press. Professor Williamson, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yesterday, a march was held to commemorate the 35th anniversary of a march of black students to the Alana Union, fall of 1968, the year of the implementation of Project 500, the Special Educational Opportunities Program. Tell us about that program. What was Project 500?
Project 500 was the University of Illinois' first foray into affirmative action. And in 1968, through this SEOP program, Special Educational Opportunities Program, or Project 500 for short, over 500 black students primarily were enrolled at the University of Illinois, more than doubling the total student population, this total black student population on campus. In 1967, there were only 223 black undergraduate students. And in 1968, the university brought down over 500 black students.
So it was a tremendous achievement.
It was.
Okay. But then it was, not only was it a tremendous achievement, but it also changed the situation on campus. And the university had wanted to do something to boost the number of black students on campus. And then when all these students were here suddenly, well, there was some tension, there was some difficulty, and the students marched from a residence hall to the Alana Union.
They did. Actually, the number of students in the program was increased from 200 to 500 after Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated in April of 1968. Originally, the university had planned to bring down 200 black students, which was still a very aggressive program because there were only 223 total students on campus. Then Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated, and the university decided, somewhat on its own and somewhat from pressure from outside agencies, to increase the number of black students that would be admitted through the program. And so during this year, this is 1968, black power sentiment is on the rise, and these students who arrive in Champaign to attend the University of Illinois are bringing this ethos with them, and they end up spending time. Their first week on campus is as only black students on campus. It was an early orientation program and felt very much like a black college campus. And when it was time for them to move into their regular room assignments, they were living in ISR, Illinois Street Residence Hall. And there were several women who decided they didn't want to leave ISR. And students were very afraid of being split up. They were worried about losing the camaraderie that mm-hmm. they had experienced during that week. And in an effort to be a cohesive group, the Black Students Association, these women who had protested these room assignments, housing staff and other administrators met to discuss these issues at Illinois Street Residence Hall, ISR, and eventually students moved from ISR to the Illini Union just as these students yesterday mimicked. They went to the union because their numbers were growing too large. They were congregated outside the union to discuss these different issues, housing issues and financial aid issues, and were forced inside because it started to rain. And when they were forced inside, they refused to leave until after the union's closing time and were subsequently arrested.
Yeah, they wanted to meet with an administrator.
In particular, Jack Peldison, the chancellor at the time.
Yeah. Now, this was a very peaceful happening.
Right.
But it was described as a riot.
The Chicago Tribune and other news outlets really skewed their interpretation of the event and did not have accurate information. And so not only was it skewed, it was inaccurate. And it heightened tensions on campus. And so it was a sit-in. And so you have these students basically sitting in the Illini Union. Some of them are there because they really do want to force the university to negotiate with them. Others are afraid to leave because they've heard rumors that there are police outside with dogs and billy clubs. There weren't, but there were these rumors. Mm-hmm. And these students have been watching the news and had seen police dogs and billy clubs used on black people previously. And so they were authentically scared. So students stayed at the union for a variety of reasons. But it gets characterized as a riot in a variety of different news outlets, although it was really just a sit-in.
Yeah. And still some students were arrested.
Right. About 250 students, most of them freshmen, who had not even attended a class yet.
Mm. What happened to those students?
The arrested students?
Yeah.
The university the university tried to figure out what to do with them. Some people thought they should be expelled. Some people thought they should be suspended. Others thought no action should be taken against the students. But the university, through one of its disciplinary subcommittees, did pursue disciplinary action against the students. Also, the Champaign County's state's attorney filed charges against the students. And so these cases weren't cleared up for several months, particularly for the continuing students.
Yeah. And did any of those students have to leave the U of I?
No. None of them were forced to leave the institution. I don't think that the University of Illinois really wanted to kick these students out. It was more angry citizens and legislators who wanted these students gone. I don't think that the campus wanted to use this as a way to force black students out.
Well, also with the misrepresentation in the media, it had to have made it tough.
It made it incredibly tough on administrators and students because now they all have to defend this program that has everybody considered good. But this sit-in happens, it's mischaracterized as a riot, and the Chicago Tribune estimates $50,000 worth of damage, which was inaccurate. And so it increases the level of hostility towards the university as well as to its black students in particular.
Well, also those students had to deal with their parents.
Most of them freshmen hadn't even attended a class, and now they're calling home for bail money.
Yeah.
Their parents weren't too happy receiving those kinds of phone calls from their kids.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this program more specifically now, the Special Educational Opportunities Program, Project 500,
right,
for short. You say in Black Power on Campus there were programs like this across the country aimed at alleviating racial injustice, but you say this program here at Illinois was unique for a couple of reasons.
Right.
How?
One was the sheer number of students involved. Most institutions were not as aggressive in their recruitment efforts. And so places like Cornell, you might get maybe 100 students enrolled through a program or 50 more students enrolled at a different kind of an institution. But Illinois brought down, it was over 500 students. And there were some white students and Puerto Rican students involved in Project 500. But the predominant numbers were for black students. And also the level of involvement that students had in helping to not necessarily create the program, but mold the program. Students had a lot of input. They participated in recruitment. They participated in a variety of different ways where students had not previously participated.
So there hadn't been anything like that student influence before?
None whatsoever. Students and administrators were forced into very close contact after these Project 500 students came to campus, closer contact than administrators and students had ever experienced before or since.
Now, we've got these 500 African-American students, or I guess you said that there were other students primarily.
There were 565 students, and I believe over 500 were black, so almost 90%, probably a little bit more than 90% black students.
Okay. And out of a total student body at that time?
They were still only about 1%, maybe they were 2% at that time, so there were probably about 25,000 undergraduates here. during that time, maybe 23,000. And so it's still relatively small, but for the students, it felt like a huge swell of their numbers, which it was, because compared to the year previous when there were only 223, now you add to it these students through Project 500, as well as other black students who were already admitted to the University of Illinois as freshmen without this program. So that increases the number of black freshmen. Not all black freshmen were members of Project 500. So it was a significant increase for the black student population, but they were still dwarfed in comparison to the general population.
That makes solidarity a very important issue.
Incredibly important.
Yeah. Joyanne Williamson is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with her about Black Power on Campus, the University of Illinois, 1965-75. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the discussion with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-9455. 800-222-9455. If the local number doesn't work for you, by the way, give us a call on the toll-free line, 800-222-WILL. Well, at this point in time, it's now 1968, what were the concerns of black students attending the University of Illinois?
In 1968, their concerns were relatively dispersed. In February of 1969, students create a list of demands, and this is where their ideas on how to change the campus become manifest. And so half of the demands have to do with the campus itself and black student life on campus and policy and programs on campus, and the other half deal with Champaign community concerns. And they included, they were advocating for, I think it was a living wage, and they included the words black and white employees of the university. And so their demands were certainly focused on black students, but there were some issues and individuals, white individuals, that they considered allies in the cause. And so it was in these demands that these black power ideas became manifest, and they demanded a cultural center, a black studies program, increased black faculty, increased black students, improved employment opportunities for Champaign residents on the campus, increased university outreach to the black community. And so it was a very varied list of demands that they created.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned white students or whites. Did white students play a role in pressuring the university to commit itself to these issues? And what were relationships between whites and blacks on campus?
The white students and the black students lived parallel but not intersecting lives. And so white students did support the black students in certain respects with some of the demands, but white students were consumed with their own protest issues, including Vietnam War issues and recruiting on campus and the draft and free speech issues. And so white students are forcing the university's hand in a different way. So the university administrators, I'm sure, felt under siege from the student body. And so black students very rarely supported white students in the sense that they would turn out for rallies and participate in different kinds of activities. White students sometimes or on occasion would show up for rallies or create a petition list to support black students in a particular cause. But in large part, they lived very parallel but not intersecting lives.
A very segregated kind of situation.
When I was here as an undergraduate, it was very similar.
Really? And mm-hmm. You were here in the 90s?
I got here as an undergraduate in 1989 and was here until 1993 as an undergrad. Then I remained for my PhD. But when I was an undergraduate student, the campus was very segregated.
Yeah. Well, you're back here now. How do things look today?
I'm not sure. It's hard to know. Even when I was a graduate student, you don't participate in the social atmosphere. Obviously, in classes, everybody takes these classes because you have to graduate. It's really in the social environment where racial segregation becomes much more apparent. And because I had opted out of the social spaces as a graduate student, I wasn't as keenly aware of campus politics. And now I've haven't had the chance to really kind of talk to students very much to see how they feel about the campus, how they experience it.
Yeah. How long are you here before I have to go back to Stanford?
I leave on Sunday morning.
Oh, okay.
I arrived on Wednesday night, and I'll leave on Sunday morning.
How does it feel to be coming back?
It feels very strange. If things look very different. Green Street is completely different. And then I drove down past the past Memorial Stadium and Assembly Hall, and there are all these buildings out there now that didn't exist when I was here. And a lot of things look the same, but there's a lot of changes.
Yeah.
It just feels, I missed being at, I liked the University of Illinois. I like big campuses. And it reminded me, I was driving around during when classes were switching. It reminded me how many students attend this institution. And it's so much bigger than Stanford. And I loved the anonymity. It felt very urban compared to Stanford, which is much larger in space, but with fewer students. Here we're much smaller in space, but more students. And it felt very cosmopolitan. I know it feels... It sounds strange to say that about Champaign-Urbana, but just the sheer volume of students was a surprise. Yes.
And for a block, you can drive south on Wright Street.
Yeah, it's bizarre. They've got all kinds of traffic patterns now that are very different.
Very different. We've got a listener waiting to talk with us this afternoon here on Line 1, a caller in Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Hi. You mentioned that one of the things that... was contended for were, you know, beyond what you would normally regard as the province of educational equity, like you mentioned the living wage, you mentioned a brief for the community, basically, and then part of that was the black community. I think at some point in the situation in those days, it was realized that... the Illini Union, which you've mentioned in as a refuge from the rain after a demonstration and the sit-in and things, the union was not available to community members. There was a long pattern of African American youth and youth, I think, generally coming in and being ejected because they were persona non grata. And I think that was one of the things that's overturned. And it's a curious irony that I think we're back to the status quo ante, that actually the Illini Union is again regarded as preserve of the students, and that may or may not be. I think the argument was made that, you know, everyone in this community is, but you know, in some way or another, pays taxes. This is a public institution. Public events should be made available to all the public, and et cetera, et cetera. And but I think that actually that's one of the things that has gone back to. And it's not a big issue, maybe, compared to educational equity, et cetera, but it's still a community, and maybe I'm wrong.
I think you're right.
I'd be happy if I was wrong about the fact that it's still. I think that if you go in and you're cool and you're not loud or something that they can always eject people on their discretion or something like that. So it's I don't know. It's just an interesting dynamic it's also interesting to me because, as you say, you kept referring to Project 500 being brought down. There was a lot of schism, town and gown, Chicago and townies, and there are all sorts of dynamics that were going on. I have some firsthand memory of this, but if you study it, you probably will jar a lot of memories that I probably don't actually recall right now. And it's nice to hear that somebody has systematically studied it, and I hope some other people will call in with their insights too, because. I think I was mainly fighting the war at the time, as you pointed out. So, all right. Well, I'll listen to you respond to that, and I have to do something, so I'll listen off the air. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Well, I think you bring up a good point. The union was a major source of contention because the university then, as now, and it's not just the University of Illinois, particularly public institutions, have to figure out their relationship to the immediate community in which they're located. And this is for all institutions, and the Illini Union became a flashpoint for community members for employment purposes. And there was also a kind of a civil service exam that was restricting the kinds of employees who would be employed by the University of Illinois, and black students and black Champaign community residents worried about the impact of this on the employment of black people on campus. But institutions are always grappling with what their relationship should be to the surrounding community? Should those community members be allowed to participate in campus events? How will the university perform different kind of outreach to that community? And it's something that the University of Illinois continues to grapple with, particularly because it's a public campus where it's state-supported and tax-supported. But what does that mean? Do community members have access to the union, to the library? How autonomous is the campus from different communities? And so it's a good point that the University of Illinois has to continue to grapple with.
Yeah. And would you want to, the caller raised the issue of the difference between urban Chicago students coming to the campus and the political climate here.
Well, and actually another point that he made was the schism between Black students and Black Champaign community residents. The Black students were not allowed to live on campus in the dorms until 1945. And so previous to that, Black students had no choice but to live with Black Champaign residents in the north end of Champaign and walk or take a bus, if there was a bus service available, to campus. They couldn't eat on campus. They couldn't eat even in a desegregated eating establishment because Champaign wasn't desegregated until the early 1960s. The theaters were segregated, barbershops were segregated, the eating establishments were segregated. And so Black students relied heavily on the Black Champaign community. They were basically the same. When students are able to move into the dorms, it changes the nature of the relationship. And in the late 1960s, these Black students coming, most of them from Chicago, very few Black students came to the university from Champaign or Urbana at this time or even now. These students come down with this Black Power ethos, and they are deliberate about their pursuit of relationships with the Black Champaign community, as is the Black Champaign community toward Black students. And so you see them attempting to forge a much more close relationship than had existed probably in the mid-1950s and into the 1960s when students began to just visit the Black community for services, but then return to campus. And so there's this town and gown split. And this isn't just for Black students, but it was heightened at this point in time with the Black Champaign community and the Black student community.
Hmm. Let's go back to the early 60s. In the early 60s, even though your book deals with 65 to 75, that decade, you do cover early 60s. Mm-hmm. And the university at that time was examining the issue of underrepresentation. What came out of the work of the Committee on Human Relations and Equal Opportunity?
That was a committee, I believe it was devised in about 1963. There's this, and this is firmly located in the civil rights movement. And so I do not believe that institutions on their own decided to make changes. I don't believe in a top-down understanding of reform. I prefer to understand history as an organic event where it's bottom-up. And so you have the civil rights movement forcing people to entertain these particular questions, and then institutions respond. Mm-hmm. And so the university, one of the ways that they responded was to form this committee to discuss the role of a public institution. Is it the intellectual leader of the state? Is it a place where social revolutions are born and are fermented? What role will a state institution play for that state? And one of the answers that they come up with is that they need to much more aggressively try and educate all Illinois citizens, or a cross-section of all Illinois citizens, and dedicate themselves to a diverse campus, as well as helping to improve society by the kinds of students that they bring and the kind of education that they provide for those students. And so the university sees itself as a social change agent. And because of that, these different programs, admissions programs and support programs and retention programs, start to be considered out of this committee.
Yeah. At the same time, though, the university is very aware of how its response might be viewed across the state and with various constituencies
right.
In the state. The university, you say, was cautious in how to describe what it was going to do.
It was very cautious. Even now, affirmative action provokes a variety of different reactions. this is at the beginning of affirmative action, and so nobody really understood what it meant, what it would look like, who would be able to partake of it. And so, again, as a state institution, the campus had to be very careful in how it described its role and how these students were admitted, because this is also the first time when the university had to stop admitting everyone who applied. There was actually competition for admission in the 1960s, and because of that competition, when it seemed, or the media was portraying these black students as undeserving, they were receiving their education tuition free, they were unqualified. These were all buzzwords that we still hear today, and it really angered Champaign constituents, Illinois citizens, and state legislators. And so the university had to be very cautious in how it described the program in the press.
So how did it go about doing that? How did it allay concern that students admitted through this program would take the opportunity of admission away from qualified white students?
Yeah, because actually that's what happened, is that unqualified became synonymous with black and qualified became synonymous with white. One of the ways the university did it was to remind people that these students met standard admissions requirements. So that these were not unqualified students. They also admitted these students on top of the regularly admitted class, because the number 500 didn't come about until May of 1968. This is when Project 500 is announced as a program. Well, school starts in September, and so these students were admitted on top of the regular student body. So it was not taking any spaces from students. And it also discussed its larger mission, the fact that scores alone never dictated who was admitted to the University of Illinois. There were always a variety of factors that played into who was admitted. And they also publicly questioned the accuracy of the ACT. And so they use these kinds of mechanisms to try and allay these fears. Sometimes they were successful, sometimes they weren't.
Yeah. Trying to put this program together fairly quickly for a big institution, what did that involve in having to move so quickly? Did that lead to some problems?
It led to huge missteps. And that, as I believe, is what precipitated the arrest at the Union. The university received 1,300 applications to participate in the program. They extended 768, I believe, offers of admission. And the university regularly hypothesized that about two-thirds of the students, or maybe a little less than that, actually accept. And so they didn't expect 768 acceptances. But when 565 students say, yes, I'm coming, this was many more students that the university anticipated. And it was also summer vacation was coming up, and so they were short-staffed over the summer, whether it was recruitment, housing, the financial aid office, I think, is what became incredibly problematic, because they were short-staffed, and there was actually a transition of financial aid directors during the same time. Clarence Shelley had just been hired to come to campus, and so you've got a lot of new staff, you've got a lot of missing staff for the summer, and so the quickness of the program really impacted how these students experienced their first week or so on campus. It was obvious that the university had not had the time to adequately plan for the arrival of these students and what that arrival would mean for the campus.
Yeah. Well, of course, you talked with Clarence Shelley for this.
I did.
For this book. You interviewed him. What did he tell you about this period of time?
He remembers it very fondly, but he also remembers it as very stressful. He was caught because of who he is and the role he was playing. He was dean of students, but people called him the Black Dean. That was not his official title, but that's what students called him. And students continue to call him Dean Shelley, even though he retired as vice chancellor. He enjoyed the time, but worried about the students quite a bit, their psychological health, their academic well-being. And he was in a unique position because he was an administrator. But the students basically felt like they owned him. He was one of the only people the students respected completely and trusted completely. And so he was often caught between students and administrators trying to pull him in different directions. And so trying to walk that tightrope could be very stressful. But I believe he considers it an incredibly rewarding time, and I know he's looking forward to meeting with a variety of different alums who are going to be coming back visiting the campus for this commemoration.
Yeah. By the way, one of our reporters, Ali Kewa, interviewed Clarence Shelley yesterday, and we're going to air that interview this afternoon here on this program at 2:40. And also, listeners, you'll find it on our website, WILL.UIUC.edu. And also there on the website is a link to the university's site that lists the commemorative events and activities for the Brown v. Board anniversary. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Joy Ann Williamson is our guest this afternoon here on the program. We're talking with her about her book, Black Power on Campus, the University of Illinois, 1965-75. She is here in town, in Champaign-Urbana, as part of the university's commemoration of the 50th anniversary of Brown. Later today, she'll speak at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. That's on the second floor. That event is set for 4:30 this afternoon, the 17th of October. And the bookstore, of course, is located at Wright and Daniel Streets in Champaign. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers, 333-9455. That's the number for the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, for the students, what kind of support did Project 500 give them?
I think it alleviated the numerical isolation that students were experiencing. The students that I interviewed who attended the university before Project 500 remembered it as intensely lonely, lonely enough that 30 years later, they were brought to tears by remembering how alone they felt. The small numbers of black undergraduates did not mean a cohesive black community. They were so spread out. It's a big campus, and it was hard for them to find each other. When Project 500 starts, continuing students are ecstatic. They get to participate in the recruitment of these students. They get to help acclimate them to campus. They believe that this is going to offer them a variety of different friendship groups, a support system, a social support system that had not existed previously. And so even just the sheer appearance of these students, that just their numbers alone helped to alleviate some of the numerical isolation that students were experiencing.
Were there special programs, special events
before 1968?
Yeah.
No. Students would create different opportunities for themselves. There were fraternities and sororities, black fraternities and black sororities on campus, but not all of them, not all of the students participated in them. And actually, some of them would host parties where only black Greeks were allowed. So black students who were non-Greeks couldn't attend, nor could black Champaign community residents. And so you have this Greek versus non-Greek split, which exacerbates the black Champaign community and black student relationship. And there were there was a campus chapter of the NAACP, which was racially mixed. So there were some social movement kinds of organizations on campus. But in 1967, black students create the Black Students Association, or BSA, to create a conduit for black student concerns. And that was really, and this was before the 68 group arrived, and this was really their first attempt to define themselves as a cohesive black community and create a voice for black students on campus.
Yeah, you know, of course, that this was a time when Negro and black were being redefined.
Right.
How was that expressed on campus and through the Black Students Association?
The term Negro, black students threw off the term Negro before white students or white media did. And so you see, even into 1968, the Chicago Tribune was using the word Negro. In none of the Black Student Association publications did I ever see the word Negro used as a descriptive self-referent. Rather, it became a derogatory term. And so based on student records that students had to fill out upon enrollment, students had a variety of categories they could choose from. And at one point, both Negro and black were included. And students at one point were checking Negro at a much more higher rate. But then there's a complete switch to claiming black as a racial self-referent, as well as a political ideology. It's the way kind of the difference between African-American and black is understood. African-American is, a basic ethnic or racial category. Black brings with it not only that racial and ethnic category, but also a degree of political consciousness.
Mm. When and how did Afro-American studies come to be established on campus?
It was one of the demands of the students to have a black studies program. And this was very typical during the time. The first black studies program was started in California in 1966. And so the students here at Illinois demand an autonomous program in 1969 with their demands. The university and students work together to try and devise a program, and it takes quite a while. The university was interested and anticipated demands like this. They just did not understand the way that students would pursue these demands and the kinds of ways they would make these demands. And so the students demand an autonomous black studies program. They want more black professors on campus to be able to teach in it. The debate becomes, can white professors teach black studies? Who should run a black studies department? Should it be a department which is autonomous, or a program which is not autonomous, which means that it's interdisciplinary and has faculty from a variety of different other departments on campus? And it takes a few years for what's now called the Afro-American Studies and Research Program to get off the ground. So the demand is made in 69. It becomes a real entity around 71, 72, but it doesn't gain any real sense of legitimacy until, I believe, it's 1974, because there was such a turnover in directors that devising a program became virtually impossible. And so I believe their first full-time director was in 1974.
Wow. At this time, too, there was an African-American or a black cultural
right.
center. You quote Clarence Shelley as saying both of these things were really important
right.
to students.
Right. And actually, it's called the Afro-American Cultural Program, but students call it the Black House. So its technical name. Actually, now I've heard that it's being changed to the Bruce D. Nesbitt African-American Cultural House, something like that. This is, I think, tomorrow they're actually going to commemorate or change the name. But students call it the Black House. And so the Black Studies Department was the academic department, the academic component. The cultural center was the social space, as well as, so students were creating and experimenting with different cultural forms. And it became a safe haven for black students on campus, a place where they knew other black students would be. If they were seeking out black students, they knew that they could find them there. So it was incredibly important to the black student community, as it remains today.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. Anyway, I had 2 points to make. I got my degrees from the U of I. Our sons got their degrees from the U of I. And here's a question. From Adam's Rib to Women's Lib, do you think we've come a long way, baby? I have not read the book, and I'll hang up and listen to the answer of your guest.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
If I'm understanding your question, have things changed much since this period in time? I believe the answer is, in large part, yes. I was able to, when I was a student here, to visit the cultural center without being arrested. I was able to take courses that were African-American focused, or at least had African-American content in them. I was able to take courses with black professors. I was able to participate in a variety of different activities and feel comfortable on campus. And so not all of the activities I participated in were black focused, but I believe that the ethos of the campus has certainly changed since the mid-1960s. But because the university, like all universities, is a microcosm of society, problems continue to exist outside the university. Therefore, problems continue to exist inside the university. And so, and professors are people too, as are students. And so people bring a variety of different ideas on appropriate behavior and political proclivities and different kinds of sentiment about people different from them. And that spills out into student interaction on campus, as well as interaction between students and faculty and students and administrators. And so, yes, I believe that the campus has changed. And I believe now with a new chancellor, this commitment to diversity is incredibly serious. She takes it very seriously. But I believe there's a little bit more work to be done.
To follow up on that listener's call, though, I want to ask you, how did the black student movement affect other groups of students tremendously?
They did. That's a good question. These black students issued their demands in 1969, and a cultural center and a studies program are two of the things that come out of this. Latino students are the next group of students who demand a cultural center and receive a cultural center. I believe it was in 1974 that Latino students received a cultural center on campus. Then there's a spillover into Latino studies programs. Then there's a women's studies program. And then there's a now most recently an Asian American studies program. And so just as the civil rights movement and the black power movement trickled into other movements like the women's movement and other varieties of different movements, so too did the black student movement trickle down into other groups defining themselves as communities who need certain kinds of support systems.
Yeah, and also Native American students.
Exactly.
Yeah. How did you think the Black Students Association and Project 500 change the campus long term? Maybe we've talked about this some, but maybe you could really sum it up for us.
I think the reforms that came out of that time, it was a joint effort between students and administrators, but it was the students through BSA and then the numbers in Project 500 that really forced the issue and helped to define the issue in a particular way. The way that the university had gone about improving the quality of life for black students was very different from the way that black students believed that their quality of life would be improved. And so it was these black students, I believe, that really precipitated the conversations on reform and helped direct the forms that these reforms would take. And administrators worked with them on what they believed were legitimate concerns and helped to mold and shape some of these demands. But I believe that BSA and these Project 500 students really forced the issue, pushed the envelope, and forced the university to think in ways that it hadn't previously done.
Yeah. At the end of the book, you quote Clarence Shelley
mm-hmm.
about the legacy.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're the closing words of the book. What did he say about the legacy?
I asked each of the interviewees, what do you believe the legacy is? And he said, I think the legacy is about the possibilities for change, which I thought was a really interesting way to put it. And so not that everything had been decided, but that the university was much more open and malleable than it had been previously. And so he believes that this possibility of change is the greatest legacy that came out of that time.
And it also says it's not over.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. The students who came to Illinois during this period of time, those you interviewed, how do they feel about what they accomplished?
They're very proud of it. I think a lot of them have not been back to campus in a while, and they'll be arriving. They're probably here now or will be arriving tomorrow to participate in this commemoration. I think they're intensely proud of the time. They left with some serious scars, but they're intensely proud of what they were able to accomplish and the friendships, the long-lasting friendships that were forged at that time. There are still students who call each other each September 9th, the day that they were arrested at the Union, to commemorate the arrest. And so what turned out, what began as an incredibly stressful situation, evolved into a kind of forced camaraderie amongst these students. And so they look back on it as a time of fondness. They made lifelong friends. They had a good time, but it was a very stressful time. And so some of them have very mixed feelings about the university, but they're all very proud about the legacy that they left.
Mm. Joy, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Joy Ann Williamson has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Black Power on Campus, the University of Illinois, 1965-75. She's an alumna of the University of Illinois. She is an assistant professor of education at Stanford University. Later today, the 17th of October, she'll speak at the Alana Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. That event is set for 4:30 this afternoon. The 17th of October in the Alana Union Bookstore is at the corner of Wright and Daniel Streets in Champaign. Oh, by the way, I did want to also mention that Black Power on Campus is published by the University of Illinois Press.